Moreover, the monks, initiates of the mysteries of Jesus, would not be likely to hand over their sacred places to the despoilers with any goodwill. It has been reported again and again that a curse rests on those who profited by the spoliation of church lands. This is too well known to require discussion in these pages. There is another fact in connection with church property, however, which may not be so well known, and that is the frequency with which psychic happenings are reported in connection with vicarages. In inquiring among friends and fellow workers for data in connection with the research that has gone to the making of this book, I have been astonished how frequently a vicarage has been mentioned in connection with the phenomena of which I have been told. The rituals of the church are, of course, ceremonial magic, as is admitted by even such an orthodox authority as Evelyn Underhill. The average clergyman is not conversant with the technique of occultism, and has therefore little or no understanding of what he is doing. What influences he brings to the altar, and what forces he takes away therefrom, must therefore be an open question in each individual case. A man whose consciousness has been exalted by ritual, and who does not know how to seal his aura and return to normal, is liable to psychic invasion. Objects associated with any form of ceremonial operations are invariably highly charged with magnetism and intimately linked with the force whose uses they have served. I remember, many years ago, when I had but little knowledge of occultism and no pretensions at all to psychism, that two friends and myself were amusing ourselves by turning over each other's trinket boxes. I picked up a handsome amethyst cross from one of them, and immediately exclaimed, "There is something extraordinary about this cross. It feels as if it were alive." "That was the cross that was given me at my first communion," replied my friend, "and it was originally a bishop's pectoral cross." Her sister was greatly interested, and immediately brought her own jewel case to me and asked me if I could pick out her first communion cross also, for, like her sister, she was a Roman Catholic, and these crosses that were given them as presents on the occasion of their first communion had been specially blessed by the priest. I was greatly interested to observe that from three or four ornamental crosses I was able to pick one which felt warm and living and electric to the hand, and pass it across to her, saying, "This is your communion cross," and it was. I remember once, as a small child, picking up a dying rook. The creature lay motionless on my knee for a few minutes, and then gave a flutter and died. I had never seen death before, but I needed no one to tell me that I saw it now. There, feel of the creature, before and after that flutter, was different. I can only compare the feel of the magnetized and the unmagnetized crosses to the difference between the living and the dead bird. But the Christian is not the only religion that can magnetize its ceremonial instruments. There are other ritualistic religions, and some of these are debased. We ought to use much caution before we place about our rooms as ornaments objects which may have been associated with cults whose nature we do not understand. Many of them, of course, belong to the Brahmajam cult, and are dedicated to no more desperate deity than Mammon, but the genuine curio is a different matter. I had an example of this once in the British Museum. I was visiting the room in the basement which contains a collection of plaster casts of the famous statues of antiquity, the originals being elsewhere. Suddenly I became aware of a sense of magnetic power. I turned towards it, and saw a small altar. Reading the label, I found that this was not a cast but the original. It is a very interesting test of psychism to sample the atmosphere of the different rooms of the British Museum. The benign and brooding peace of the Buddhist room is a thing to be remembered. The flavor of the long ethnological room is a thing to be got out of the mouth as quickly as possible. To me, at any rate, the Egyptian room is disappointing. The mummies all seem neither malignant or benignant, but merely cynical. Perhaps I should feel differently, however, if I spent a night with them. Magnetism, which is dispersed during the day, charges up again during the silence and darkness of the night. I remember visiting Stonehenge amid a crowd of trippers and charzablanks, and thinking that the glory had departed, but it was a very different affair when I visited it in the desolation of a bleak spring day after its long winter solitude. It had charged up again, and was as formidable as anyone could wish. I should hesitate, therefore, to say that because the mummies and I have never struck sparks when we met in the British Museum, that their reputation is groundless. At the time that Tutankhamen's tomb was being opened, I said to myself, if the mummy's curse does not work in this case, I shall lose my faith in occultism. We all know how it has worked, even unto the third and fourth generation. No novelist, deriving his ideas of ancient Egypt from an encyclopedia article on Egyptology and some photographs, would have dared stretch the long arm of coincidence anything like as far. The Egyptians attached great importance to the preservation of the physical body. The tombs of great men, as is well known, were protected by means of what are popularly called spells, and the power and scope of Egyptian magic are things that very few people realize. The modern student of occultism who reads iamblic shows on the Egyptian mysteries will have a surprise. In most cases, however, the purchaser of Egyptian curios has nothing to fear. The worst that they will yield to psychic investigation is a vision of labor disputes in a mass production factory. I have, however, heard of a very wonderful psychometric reading which was obtained from a mummy which, when subsequently unrolled, was found to consist entirely of French newspapers of recent date. I have always been greatly amused by the indignation of Egyptologists against tomb robbers. After all, is there any distinction between the earlier and later visitors to a tomb save that one lot work by day and the other by night? In the view of the people who made the tomb, and spared nothing to render it inviolate and preserve the peace of their dead, the workers by night would probably be preferred, for they merely robbed, and did not strip and expose the nude bodies to the public gaze. There was a terrible outcry recently when some bodies were moved in a village churchyard to make room for the monument chosen to decorate the grave of a famous public man. Even the people whose religious feelings were not outraged by this act of sacrilege regarded it as in shocking bad taste. Yet nobody proposed to strip the grave clothes from the body of someone's wife or mother and photograph it stark naked. When it comes to the question of a mummy's curse, I am afraid that my sympathies are entirely with the mummy. The initiate is strictly counseled that he should never blaspheme the name by which another knoweth his god, for it is the same force that he himself worships represented by another symbol. The ways to God are as many as the breaths of the sons of men, says the old Arab proverb. We should have enough sympathy with the struggles of another soul towards the light not to desecrate the things that are sanctified by his helps and endeavors, even if by nothing else. The father of us all may understand their significance better than we do, and by his acceptance consecrate them forever. There are many Europeans who have a great affection for the Buddha, and have his statue in their rooms, though sometimes they confuse it with Chenresi, the stout and beaming god of good luck. That the influence of that great being, the light of Asia, is noble and benignant, I would be the last to deny, but the statues of the Buddha are a different matter, and need to be approached with caution if genuine. Some of the worst black magic in the world is a debased form of Buddhism. To say this is not to insult that venerable faith, for it is only lack of opportunity that prevents the black mass from occupying that dubious eminence. In the Tibetan monasteries of the Dugpa sect there are temples each one of which contained literally thousands of statues of the Buddha. On various occasions one or another of these monasteries has been raided, either by rival religionists or Chinese troops, and its curios scattered. To be the possessor of one of these Buddhas, magnetized by Dugpa rites, is not a very pleasant thing. I had a curious experience with a Buddha upon one occasion. It was an archaic soapstone statuette, some 9 inches high, and its owner had dug it up herself on the site of a Burmese city that had fallen in ruin and been swallowed by the jungle. It was placed on the floor in an angle of the stairs, and served as a doorstop upon occasion. I had a flat on the top floor, and had to pass the melancholy little Buddha each time I came in or went out, and to me it seemed a desecration to see the sacred symbol of another faith treated thus. I tried to point this out to her, and asked her how she would feel if she saw a crucifix thus utilized, but without result. Meanwhile the little Buddha sat there patiently, getting the carpet sweeper pushed in his face and receiving libations of slops. One day, passing upstairs bearing a bunch of flowers, I was prompted to throw before him one of the traditional marigolds of Indian devotion. Immediately I was conscious that a link had been formed between myself and the little statue, and that it was sinister. A night or two afterwards I was returning home rather late, and as I passed the Buddha I had a feeling that there was something behind me, and looking over my shoulder, saw a ball of pale golden light about the size of a football separate itself from the Buddha and come rolling up the stairs after me. Thoroughly alarmed, and disliking this manifestation very much indeed, I immediately made a banishing gesture and the ball of light returned down the stairs and was reabsorbed into the Buddha, who, needless to say, got no more marigolds from me, and received a very wide berth until I left the flat shortly after. The experience was a singularly unpleasant one, and was a sharp lesson to me not to meddle with the sacred objects of another system unless I knew exactly what I was about. I learned subsequently that some of these statues are consecrated with the blood of a human sacrifice. I do not mean to imply by this that all Buddhist statues have been so treated. Such consecrations are, I should imagine, comparatively rare, but I think no one who has a knowledge of the facts will deny that they occurred, even as one might occasionally come across a crucifix which had been used upside down at a black mass. It is not every case of psychic disturbance, however, which originates externally. It is a well-known cosmic law that everything moves in circles, and whatever forces we send out, and whatever thought forms we extrude from our auras, unless absorbed by the object to which they are directed, will return to us in due course. One of the most effective, and also one of the most widely practiced methods of occult defense is to refuse to react to an attack, neither accepting nor neutralizing the forces projected against one, and thus turning them back on their sender. We must never overlook the fact that a so-called occult attack may be evil thought forms returning home to roost. There are certain types of insanity in which the lunatic believes himself to be the victim of an attack by invisible beings, who threaten and abuse him and offer base or dangerous insinuations. He will describe his tormentors, or point to their position in the room. A psychic who investigates such a case can very often see the alleged entities just where the lunatic says they are. Nevertheless, the psychologist can come forward and prove beyond any reasonable doubt that the so-called hallucinations are due to repressed instincts giving rise to dissociated complexes of ideas in the patient's own subconscious mind. Does this mean that the psychic is mistaken in thinking he perceives an astral entity? In my opinion, both psychic and psychologist are right, and their findings are mutually explanatory. What the psychic sees is the dissociated complex extruded from the aura as a thought form. A great deal of relief can be given to lunatics by breaking up the thought forms that are surrounding them, but unfortunately the relief is short-lived, for unless the cause of the illness can be dealt with, a fresh batch of thought forms is built up as soon as the original ones are destroyed. Chapter 7. The Pathology of Non-Human Contacts. There are other forms of life as well as ours whose sphere of evolution impinges upon the earth. In the realm of folklore we constantly meet with the idea of intercourse between the human and the fairy kingdoms, of the marriage of a human being with a fairy spouse, or the theft of a child by the fairies, an impish changeling being left in its place. We shall be rash if we assume that an extensive body of folk belief is entirely without foundation in fact. Let us therefore examine these old and crude beliefs and see whether we can find any grounds for them, and if so, what the real nature of the facts may be, and whether they throw any light upon modem psychic phenomena of the kind we are considering in these pages. There are many of us who have met people who might well be described as non-human, soulless, in that the ordinary human motives are not operative with them, nor do the ordinary human feelings prompt or inhibit them. We cannot but love them, for they have great charm, but we cannot but dread them as well, for they spread an infinitude of suffering around them. Although seldom deliberately evil, they are singularly detrimental to all with whom they come in contact. They, for their part, are unhappy and lonely in our midst. They feel themselves to be alien and uncompanioned, every man's hand is against them, And in consequence it all too often happens that their hand is against everyone and they develop a puckish malevolence, though there is seldom calculated evil doing. Gratitude, compassion, good faith, morality and common honesty are utterly foreign to their natures, as are far beyond their conception as the differential calculus. They are not immoral, however, but simply non-moral. On the other hand, they possess the virtues of absolute sincerity and great courage. In terms of human ethics they are undesirables, but they have an ethic of their own to which they are loyal, and that is the beauty which is truth, and this is all they know, and, as far as their life is concerned, all they need to know. In appearance they are usually small and slight, possessing unusual physical strength and endurance but very liable to nervous exhaustion and brainstorms. In social relations they take violent likes and dislikes. They show a facile and demonstrative affection towards those they like, but quickly forget them. Gratitude and pity are unknown to their nature. Towards those they dislike they are pettily malicious, and in all relations of life they are utterly irresponsible. One cannot describe them better than to say that they resemble nothing so much as a blend of Persian kitten and pet monkey. They have the beauty and aloofness and charm of the cat, and the amusing, mischievous destructiveness of the monkey. Many human beings hate them at sight, others are fascinated by them because they bring with them a sense of unearthly beauty and a quickening of the life forces. I have been able to investigate the history of two such beings, and it is interesting to note that both of them were conceived while their mothers were under the influence of drink. There is a very great deal of information available concerning the occult aspect of the incarnation of souls, but not much of the knowledge concerning the actual facts of conception has ever found its way into print. I have given a little in my book, The Esoteric Philosophy of Love and Marriage. I cannot enter into the subject deeply in these pages, for it would be too much of a digression. Some points, however, it is essential to touch upon for a comprehensive survey of our subject. At the moment of sexual union a psychic vortex is formed resembling a waterspout, a funnel-shaped swelling that towers up into other dimension. As body after body engages, the vortex goes up the planes. In all cases the physical, etheric and astral bodies are involved. The vortex therefore always reaches as far as the astral plane. A soul upon the astral plane may be drawn into this vortex if it is ripe for incarnation, and thus sent to the sphere of the parents. If the vortex extends higher than the astral plane, souls of a different type may enter this sphere, but such extension is rare, and therefore it is said that man is born of desire, for few are born of anything else. But this vortex may not only extend vertically up the planes, speaking metaphorically, but it may also, under certain conditions, be deflected, as it were, out of the normal human line of evolution, so that its open end extends into the sphere of evolution of another type of life. Under such circumstances it is theoretically possible for a being of a parallel evolution to be drawn into incarnation in a human body. Occultists hold that this occasionally occurs, and explains certain types of non-pathological abnormality which are occasionally met with. 36. These non-humans are either adored or hated by their human associates. They have a peculiar fascination for certain types of temperament, the types that psychologists call the unstable. In these types the subconscious comes very near to the surface, deep calls to deep, and they are instinctively drawn towards the elemental kingdoms. There is nothing more disastrous than marriage with a non-human, for they have nothing in their nature that can satisfy the normal human yearnings for affection and sympathy. The one saving feature in such a union is that grounds for divorce are invariably readily available, for the morals of the non-human are those of the boneyard. The power of non-humans to injure their enemies is comparatively small, for they are aliens in a strange land when incarnated in human form, and cannot avail themselves of any of the ordinary human resources of mischief. They are, in fact, singularly defenseless and helpless, and themselves suffer acutely at the hands of society. It is otherwise, however, in their relations with their friends. They seem to have an infinite capacity for inflicting hurt on those who love them, not deliberately or maliciously, but like a child pulling flies to pieces out of idleness, not realizing what it is doing. Obeying the laws of their own nature, they are destructive to beings of the human evolution. Yet what other laws can they obey? For them to submit to our standards is to deny their deepest instincts. The effect they have upon those who love them constitutes such a well-marked syndrome among the psychic pathologies that we must consider it in detail. The person who forms a rapport with a non-human becomes deeply stirred by the elemental forces that find ingress to our sphere through the channel of this wandering and alien soul. He becomes, as it were, drawn away from normal human things and set wandering upon the confines of the fairy kingdom, and yet he can find the no rest for his foot and no sustenance for his soul. The story of the handsome fish lad and the mermaid is indicative of this condition. She loves him, draws him to her, and he drowns, for he cannot live in the element of water. The explanation of the curious power, both of fascination and destruction, which is exercised by non-humans may lie in the fact that they belong to one element only, whereas in man all four are combined. Any elemental contact is stimulating to us, because elemental beings pour forth in abundance the vitality of their own particular sphere, and this vitalizes the corresponding element in ourselves. But if a four-element creature is drawn into the sphere of a single element, he is poisoned by an overdose of the one element in which he finds himself, and starved of the other three. It is for this reason that mortals in the fairy kingdom are always said to be enchanted or asleep. They are never living normally in full possession of their faculties. An equally difficult problem is set to the non-human who is drawn into our midst. A single element creature is bidden to control and assimilate an additional three elements for which it has no equipment or experience, and the result is disastrous. But it is not enough that we should merely describe the conditions and state the problem in these pages. Our aim is essentially practical. What then can be done when a non-human has to be faced and dealt with? It must be clearly realized that any mating between a human and a non-human is a hopeless proposition. In the first place, it can only be the preamble to a divorce, because non-humans are promiscuous in their sexual habits, and, secondly, there is nothing in the nature of a non-human that can satisfy the higher aspirations of the human. We must not allow the human form to mislead us as to the existence of a human soul. A non-human is a pet animal, not a fellow creature. That, frankly, is the only possible ground upon which they can be approached. If we expect no more of them than we should of a pet bird, if we manage them as we should manage a kitten, we have got as near to the solution of the problem as we are ever likely to get until the dark angel mercifully restores them to their own kingdom, a mercy seldom long delayed, for non-humans do not make old bones. Human beings may also come into touch with elemental beings by themselves venturing into the spheres of elemental life. Such contacts need not necessarily be harmful to either kingdom provided those who enter into them know what they are about. In fact, such associations are frequently entered into by occultists in the course of their work and researches, but it is an undertaking for the advanced initiate only, not for neophytes. There are cases, however, where such an association may lead to harm. The human partner in the association may be ill-equipped or ill-adapted for the undertaking. He may have ventured out beyond his depth, having picked up a formula from some more experienced occultist and used it without proper preparation. Or again, it is not uncommon to find people who have brought through from previous incarnations a natural aptitude for getting into touch with their elemental kingdoms. In such cases it may occur that an elemental who has had experience of relations with human beings may deliberately get into touch with them. This is in every way undesirable, for the elemental has not got the knowledge of human conditions necessary to enable it to avoid injuring its new friend. In any case, elementals have got a one-way intelligence, and it is not well that they should be senior partners in any alliance with human beings. The whole question of elemental contacts, an exceedingly fascinating one, is too extensive and intricate to be entered upon in these pages. It has been necessary to refer to it, however, for certain cases of psychic difficulty may be due to inexpert operations on both sides of the veil. These elementals, or nature spirits, are quite different to the controls with whom spiritualistic circles come into touch. The spiritualistic movement is highly organized on the inner planes, and promiscuous controlling is not permitted. Controls have, in fact, to sit for development in just the same way that mediums do, and there is invariably some experienced entity within call who can come to the assistance of the circle if all is not going well. Western occultism was thoroughly disorganized and broken up by centuries of persecution. Its inner plane conditions, consequently, present many tangles and gaps even to this day. It is nothing like as well organized as the spiritualistic sphere. The great orders have their definite contacts and work strictly within them, keeping a firm hand on neophytes. Outside the orders there is a good deal of chaos and banditry, and it is unwise to venture far save in the company of an experienced occultist who understands the technique of the methods employed. There are many people for whom the Deva Kingdom, as the sphere which the elementals share with the nature spirits is sometimes called, has a great fascination, and they try by meditation and ritual to get into touch with it. In my opinion, it is decidedly risky for a person who is not an initiate to attempt this work. It is exceedingly apartment to lead to mental unbalance, if not to actual obsession. Not that the nature contacts are evil, but they are profoundly disturbing to the human consciousness because they stir those atavistic depths which the psychoanalyst aims at laying bare by means of his technique. Anyone who is acquainted with the literature or practice of psychoanalysis knows that the abreaction is an important factor in this system. It is a crisis, and can, for the time being at any rate, upset the patient pretty thoroughly and exacerbate all his symptoms. When we touch the elemental contacts, we get the same reaction that is caused by psychoanalysis when the sensor is being penetrated. Persons in whom the subconscious mind is near the surface, such as the artist, the crank, the unstable, and, for the matter of that, the genius in any walk of life, love the elemental contacts because they stimulate the elemental forces in their own nature which are to them the springs of their power and inspiration. But the average citizen, whose mental content is organized largely in the basis of repression and compromise in order that he may be a citizen at all and take his place in organized society, is upset by the elemental contacts according to the proportion of repression to compromise in his makeup. Compromise is the normal lot of humanity, repression is the pathology of compromise. The person who has managed to effect a working compromise between the different elements of his nature can afford to allow himself a holiday with the devas without doing anybody any harm, but the person who is repressed will find that they disagree with him actively because they are having the same effect upon him that a drastic psychoanalysis would have. We hear sometimes of the tragedy that results from taking the last dose in a bottle of tonic of which arsenic is one of the ingredients. This is due to the fact that the bottle has not been thoroughly shaken up each time a dose has been taken, so that the arsenical sediment has all collected in the last dose and reached a poisonous concentration. So it is with the elemental contacts. They are a potent tonic, but they can reach a poisonous concentration under unsuitable circumstances. I have never come across or heard of a case of pathology due to the fascination of the element of earth. It is not an element that usually attracts the amateur experimenter, though the initiate appreciates its value and importance. I have come across cases, however, of sensitive people dwelling in a mountainous country, especially in narrow gulches where there is a paucity of sunlight, who have become obsessed with the fear of the mountains. They do not fear so much that the mountains will fall upon them as that they will close over them, as the cave closed upon the children who followed the Pied Piper of Hamelin. The psychiatrist will, of course, recognize this symptom as belonging to the well-known psychoneurosis of claustrophobia. This, however, does not invalidate my statement, for in my opinion we may find that in a more intimate knowledge of the elemental kingdoms we shall come upon the clue to both claustrophobia and agoraphobia. Mountaineers also know this peculiar terror with which the great hills can obsess mankind. It is neither giddiness nor mountain sickness, but a curious oppression of the spirits by the overwhelming grandeur of nature. The same force, when not at a poisonous concentration, inspires the passion et love of the hills or of the sea that Kipling has celebrated so gloriously in one of his poems. 38. The pathologies of the element of water may be a fascination so great that a man will walk out into the sea until he drowns.